as in my own case, have actual knowledge, not just memories, and some people without the memories and without the knowledge are called upon to suffer more than they need to suffer because they will not learn by lessons of the past. We live upon this earth, we are, as you know, about 9/10 subconscious, 1/10 of us only is conscious, or at least that is the popular figure. By the sight of some of the people on certain other continents, one would doubt that people are even 1/10 conscious. But I want to say something here about other work which is done by the overself. The overself, of course, is 10/10 conscious. It has to be. 94. Otherwise the human subconscious could not be 9/10 awake. The overself is not confined to dealing with one body alone. There are different systems of utilizing the energies of the overself, and let us just briefly look at them. Some people come as a member of a group. For example, a young girl may be upon the earth and she may be quite lost and inept without the company of her brothers, her sisters, and her parents. These people, they seem to function only when they are all together. Death makes a terrific gap, while when one gets married, then the married person is always running back to the family. These people may be as puppets, all controlled by the same overself. Twins or quads often also are controlled by the same overself. It seems as if the leaders of other planes know that this particular round of existence is nearly at an end and another will start, and so they seem to be bringing people here to work in groups under the control of one overself to each group, in much the same way as a communistic dictatorship has cells of so many people under the control of one supervisor, and all the supervisors under the control of a senior supervisor, and so on. One has often seen groups of birds, perhaps 50 birds, wheeling and turning in unison as if under the command of one person. Well, that is as it should be, because these birds are all controlled by one person, in just the same way as a colony of ants is controlled by one overself, or a hive of bees is controlled by one overself. People who are more enlightened, more evolved, have a different system, and this is going to make you think. So, let us take it slowly and briefly, because actually all we have to bother about is how we are managing on this earth. Let the other worlds take care of themselves until we can get round to them. There are many different worlds like the earth. Not in the same, for want of a better word I can only call, time. But perhaps we should do better if we used a musical term, harmonics. We can have a musical note, a pure note, but then fundamentals of the original note. In much the same way there is this earth, which perhaps we should call earth D, then there are earths C, B, A, and E, F, G, for instance. These are similar earths, similar worlds, and they are called parallel. 95. Universes or parallel worlds, whichever you prefer. An overself who has evolved and who realizes that controlling just one puny little earth body is time-consuming, and not sufficiently educational, can have a puppet on each of several worlds. So that in world A, for example, little Benny can be a genius, but in world F little Freddy can be a moron. In that way the overself can see two sides of the coin at once, and can gain experience on both ends of the scale. A really experienced overself might have 9 different puppets, and that is the same as living 9 different lives, which speeds up evolution quite a bit. But this subject has already been dealt with more fully in Chapter 2. As was stated at the beginning of this chapter, poetry or verse or a definite rhythm pattern is often used to drive a matter deeply into one's subconscious. Now we are going to have an example of the type of thing which the Egyptians used to do. Unfortunately, it loses a lot of its power by being translated into English. In the original Egyptian, the word swayed rhythmically and achieved the desired purpose, but just think for yourself, if you get a piece of poetry and you translate it from English or Spanish into, let us say, German, you get the sounds all wrong, you get the balance all wrong, and so it does not have the same effect. In fact, some poems cannot be translated at all into another language, so this confession to Matt is not as good as it would be in Egyptian. This is a temple confession which was said in the chamber of Matt in the Egyptian temple of initiation. It is as written in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, it was actually an invocation. Matt, you may remember, is the Egyptian word meaning truth. So the chamber of Mat became the chamber, or temple, of truth. Here is the confession to Mat which should be repeated every night before one goes to sleep. If one repeats this as did the Egyptians, then it leads one to a much purer life. Try it and see. The confession to Mat. Homage to thee, O great God, thou master of all truth, I have come to thee, O my God, and have brought myself hither that I may become conscious of thy decrees. I know thee and am attuned with thee and thy 240 laws which exist with thee in this chamber of Mat. 96. In truth I come into thy attunement, and I have brought Mat in my mind and soul. I have destroyed wickedness for thee. I have not done evil to mankind. I have not oppressed the members of my family. I have not wrought evil place of right and truth. I have had no intimacy with worthless men. I have not demanded first consideration. I have not decreed that excessive labor be performed for me. I have not brought forward my name for exaltation to honors. I have not defrauded the oppressed of property. I have made no man suffer hunger. I have made no one to weep. I have caused no pain to be inflicted upon man or animal. I have not defrauded the temple of their oblations. I have not diminished from the bushel. I have not filched away land. I have not encroached upon the fields of others. I have not added to the weights of the scales to cheat the seller, and I have not misread the pointer of the scales to cheat the buyer. I have not kept milk from the mouths of children. I have not turned back the water at the time it should flow. I have not extinguished the fire when it should burn. I have not repulsed God in his manifestation. Affirmation. I am pure. I am pure. I am pure. My purity is the purity of the divinity of the holy temple. Therefore evil shall not befall me in this world, because I, even I, know the laws of God which are God. There are, as previously stated, occasions when prose in special form is used to drive into the subconsciousness a special message. Here is a prayer which I composed, and which you should repeat three times each morning. 97. To my over-self I pray. Let me this day, living my life day by day in the manner prescribed, control and direct my imagination. Let me this day, living my life day by day in the manner prescribed, control my desires and my thoughts that I be purified thereby. Let me this day, and all days, keep my imagination and my thoughts directed firmly upon the task which has to be accomplished, that success may come thereby. I will at all times live my life day by day, controlling imagination and thought. You should also have a prayer to be said at night, three times each night before going to sleep. Here, then, is a specially composed prayer, composed by me, which will instill discipline into your subconsciousness by night. A prayer. Keep me free from evil thoughts. Keep me free from the blackness of despair. At the time of my misery, shine a light into the darkness that enshrouds me. Let my every thought be good and clean. Let my every action be for the good of others. Let me be positive in my thoughts that my mind may be strengthened therefrom. I am the master of my destiny. As I think today, so am I tomorrow. Let me therefore avoid all evil thoughts. Let me avoid all thoughts which cause distress to others. Let my spirit arise within me that I may easily succeed in the task that lies ahead. I am the master of my destiny. So be it. 98. Chapter 6. A world we all must visit. The gentle rain came pattering down, lightly washing the soot-laden slates of the old market town. Like the tears of new widows it fell from grey skies to tinkle across the garbage cans with musical fingers. To the soft sighing of the evening wind it danced and swayed across the roadways, tapping against windows and bathing the parched foliage of such scrawny trees as still stood with lower trunks immured in concrete sidewalks. The light of passing cars reflected from the glistening roadway, their tires hissing through the thin sheet of water which collected from the poorly drained surface. Tap tap tap. Went the raindrops as they ran gleefully together from the old grey roof and flowed into the broken spout to fall onto the worn stone steps below. Passers-by hurried along, muttering imprecations against the weather, turning up collars, and erecting umbrellas. Those caught unprotected hastily improvised shelter from unfolded newspapers. A cautious cat sidled along close pressed to the houses, jumping puddles, and ever alert to find the driest places. Tiring of the wet, or possibly reaching home, the cat gave a long, cautious look around, then squeezed through a partly opened window. From around the corner came a slight, hurrying figure clad in dark raincoat and sheltering beneath a small, black umbrella. Pausing a moment beneath a street lamp, she consulted a slip of paper clutched between her fingers. Peering in the dim light, she checked again the address and number before hurrying on. Here and there she halted her hurried flight to bend forward and read the numbers on the house doors. At last, with a small exclamation, she stopped by the corner house. Hesitantly she looked at it, a small house, a poor house, with paint sun blistered on the door. The window frames were cracked for want of paint, and the stonework had seen much better days. Yet, she decided, it was a happy house. Hesitating no longer, she mounted the three small stone steps and knocked timidly at the door. Soon there came the under footsteps within the house and the slight creak as the door was opened. Mrs. Rusk, the woman on the step.
"Yes, I'm Mrs. Ryan, can I help you?" responded the other.
"Then, won't you come in out of the rain?" Gratefully the small woman folded her umbrella and stepped inside. As Mrs. Ryan took her wet coat, the slight woman looked about her. She saw an elderly, gaunt woman, with a kind face and work-worn hands. A woman who, like her house, had seen better days, but one who had well learned life's hard lessons. The furniture was clean but well worn, and the linoleum was beginning to be shabby. The slight woman turned with a start and said,
"Oh, I'm so sorry, my mind was wandering. I'm Mrs. Harvey. Mrs. Ellis told me about you. I desperately need help."
Mrs. Ryan gazed at her gravely and said, "Come into the sitting room with me, Mrs. Harvey. Let us see what the trouble is." She led the way into a small, neat room facing down the street. Motioning to a chair, she said, "Won't you sit down?" Gratefully the slight woman sank into the comfortable chair. "It's about Fred," she cried. "He died 5 weeks ago and I miss him so." Memory overcame her and she wept with an agony of emotion. Fumbling in her handbag, she withdrew her handkerchief and dabbed ineffectually at her streaming eyes. Mrs. Ryan patted her on the shoulder and said,
Now, just sit there and have your cry out. I will make a cup of tea and then you will feel better."
Hurrying from the room, she entered the kitchen, from whence soon came the clatter of teacups. "I've had a terrible time," said Mrs. Harvey later as they sat facing each other with the tea tray between them. "Fred, my husband, and I were very much in love, and then 5 weeks ago he was killed instantly in an explosion at the works. It was horrible. And every night I've had the strongest feeling that he was trying to get in touch with me, to tell me something." She stopped, and twisted her handkerchief nervously, biting her lower lip and scuffling the worn carpet on the floor. "Then Mrs. Ellis told me that you might be able to get in touch with Fred. I don't know what you charge, but I do so want to hear from him."
100. "My dear," said the elderly woman to the anxious young widow, "we can only try and trust in God. Sometimes I can receive messages from those who have left this life, other times I cannot. Only the highest adepts can always be telepathic and clairvoyant. If I can help you, then that is God's will. If I cannot, then that is God's will too. As for my charge," she waved a hand round the room, "I do not look as if I overcharged and lived in luxury, do I?" She sighed and added, "A machine could be constructed whereby this world and the unseen could communicate just as we now telephone another country. But industry is not interested. Tell me about your husband. Have you some personal article of his that I may attempt to contact him?" Much, much later, a smiling and greatly comforted Mrs. Harvey stood up to leave, and said, "I know now that there are mediums and mediums. Some are absolute swindlers, as I have found to my cost. Some raise hopes falsely and without having any ability whatever. You are very different. Thank you so much, Mrs. Ryan." As she softly closed the door after the departing Mrs. Harvey, the gaunt old medium muttered, "Lord, Lord. If only we could stop all the fakes and have real research, how easily we could then communicate. She turned back into the sitting room and slowly gathered up the tea things, thinking of a séance which she had once attended. The shops had closed early, for it was the middle of the week, when all the pay packets were empty, and larders too were becoming bare in anticipation of the morrow's shopping spree. The shops had closed early, and from the great city had flowed clerks and accountants, typists and shop girls. Great rivers of humanity had stormed the barriers at the tube stations and rushed like a roaring torrent down the escalators, sweeping along the subways to stand at last in a solid mass along the station platforms. From the deep tunnels came the reverberating vroom-vroom of the trains as they approached. At the first glimmer of train light wavering in the darkness, an uneasy surge swept the waiting masses. Strong ones pushed forward, weak ones were roughly shoved aside. As the train slowed into the station, to stop with a dying sigh of air brakes. 101. The crowd rolled forward and were engulfed by the carriages. A thud as the rubber-lined doors shut, and the dull throbbing of the air compressors pumping pressure to keep the brakes off, and the train rolled away, gathering speed, as the next wave of work-leaving humans poured down the subways to stand sheep-like on the so recently vacated platform. At last the pushing crowds thinned and dwindled to a trickle. Soon the trains became less frequent, for this was the time of home returning for the workers. Later the flow would be partly reversed as theatre-goers and window shoppers returned for their evening pleasures. Soon ladies of the night would appear, to loiter in darkened doorways or flaunt themselves beneath the lamplights. Soon policemen would saunter through the shopping areas, leisurely trying premises for unlocked doors, peering into parked cars, and being unobtrusively alert for the unusual and illegal. But not yet, the workers had but recently left for home. Far out in the suburbs people were getting up from their evening meal. Some were dressing for theatres, others were wondering how to spend an idle evening. Others were going to meetings. Down the road, in twos and threes came a small group converging on a big old house that stood back somewhat from the road, like some old person trying to keep aloof from the common herd. The bushes hiding the facade were unkempt, untrimmed, reminding one of a man with long, uncut hair on his neck. Above the portico a single unshaded bulb glowed dimly through the mess left by singed flies and insects. Briefly a face appeared at an upstairs window and peered down the road, assessing the number of people approaching, and then vanishing in the twitching of a quickly drawn curtain. Soon people were congregating at the portico, calling greetings to friends, eyeing new faces with unfriendly suspicion. Soon the door was opened, and a very large, very stout woman bedecked with strings of imitation pearls appeared. Washing her hands with invisible soap and water, she beamed toothily upon the group facing her. "Well, well," she exclaimed archly. "The spirits told me that we should have a record number tonight. Now, if you will just come in." She moved aside and people filed into the gloomy hallway. "Leave your love offerings there," said the stout woman as she pointed to a deep plate standing in an alcove. A banknote, weighted down 102, or half crowns, already rested in the capacious bottom, giving silent hints as to the amount of love offering expected. Under the watchful eyes of the stout woman the congregation fumbled in pocket and purse and dropped their offerings into the rapidly filling plate. "That's right," said the woman. "We must not let our spirit friends think their efforts are unappreciated, must we? The more we give the more we receive," she added smugly. The little group of people moved into a large room with what appeared to be a stage at one end. Hard wooden chairs were placed in irregular ranks and these were rapidly occupied by the crowd, with nervous newcomers being pushed to the back rows. The stout woman moved ponderously to the stage and took her place in the center, playing with her bracelets impatiently. A tall, thin woman appeared and sat down before a half-concealed harmonium and played the first bars of a hymn. "Just a few hymns first to get the atmosphere right," said the stout woman. "Then we will get down to business." For some minutes the organ played and the people sang, then the stout woman waved her hands imperatively and said, "Stop. Stop. The spirits are waiting. The last notes died away from the organ in a wail of diminuendo as the bellows emptied of air. There was a rustle and creak of furniture as people sat and shuffled to become at ease. The lights dimmed, went out, and were replaced by red ones which shed an eerie glow over all. Upon the platform the stout woman peered and pranced. "Oh! Boys!" she exclaimed coquettishly. "Wait, wait, you must speak in turn. There are many waiting to speak tonight," she exclaimed to her audience in an aside, "and they are very impatient. Many of you will have messages tonight," she added. For some time she writhed on the platform, giggling, and rubbing her head. "Now," she exclaimed at last, "they have had their fun. So, to business." Looking about her, she suddenly asked, "Mary, the name is Mary. Has anyone here by the name of Mary lost a dear one recently?" Dubiously a hand rose. "I lost my stepfather 6 months ago," said a nervous young woman. "He was a great sufferer. I'm sure it was a relief when he went." 103. The stout woman nodded, and remarked, "Well, he asks me to tell you that he is happy now and is sorry for all the work he caused you." The nervous young woman nodded and whispered to her companion. "Smith," called the stout woman. "I have a message for Smith. I am asked to say that you are not to worry, everything will be all right. You understand what I mean, don't you? I can hardly talk about it in a meeting like this, but you understand." Near the front a young man nodded his head in assent. "The boys are in great form tonight," said the stout woman, "they have so many messages for you. I am just like a telephone, you know, giving the messages from our dear departed who are yet with us in the spirit." "Wait, wait, what is that?" "Oh. They say that I should ask for special contributions so that I may have this room decorated. They don't like to visit shabby rooms. Will you help? Will you contribute towards this worthy cause? Miss Jones, will you pass the plate round, please? Thank you." Let it be stated at the outset that it is quite possible under certain conditions to receive messages from those who have passed over. At the same time, it must be stated equally definitely that people who have left this world have a job to do, and they do not just sit around in groups waiting like a gang of youths on a streetcomer to get a word in somehow. Many of the messages are fake messages either from elementals or from ungenuine mediums. First we should deal with one or two of the very real dangers of occultism and metaphysics, and everything else that comes within that classification. Of course there is no danger whatever to the person practicing occultism for a pure reason, I have quite a different thing in mind. One of the biggest dangers which we face is that posed by cranks, crackpots, the mentally deluded, and those who think they are Cleopatra or some such similar reincarnation. The number of Cleopatras would probably populate the whole of New York and leave an overflow for the rest of the United States. It is a most unfortunate thing that the emotionally unstable flock to occultism like flies to a jampot, and the bigger cranks. 104. They are the more danger they make for us who are trying to do a decent job. Let me make this quite definitely clear: occultism is a natural thing, there is nothing mysterious about it. It is just the use of powers which almost everyone has, of which almost everyone has forgotten how to use. Put it this way, we have an ordinary, average person who shall be our guide stick, or our yardstick. This ordinary, average person is our indicator. A person with less intellect is below average, so a denizen of a mental home can be very much below average. The subnormals, those who are below average, do not engage our attention. But those who are in possession of abilities which our average indicator does not possess, then they are above normal, paranormal. People with occult abilities are paranormal. They have abilities which are not developed in the average person. A savage has a very keen sense of smell, and often a very keen sense of sight also. He senses far above anything which the so-called civilized person does. A civilized person has the same potentialities for increased smell or sight, but conditions of alleged civilized life make the exercise of smell, power, and sight keenness a positive drawback. Think of going to some of those restaurants if one's smell was phenomenally acute, The stench would knock one over backwards. The person with occult power, then, is not a magician, not anything like that. He is just a person who has developed certain senses possessed by everyone else. In the same way we all have muscles, but the weightlifter has developed his muscles to a far greater extent than has the little old lady who sits in a chair all day long. And the man who engages in politics, he has developed his vocal cords far beyond that of the man who stays at home all the time. They both have muscles, they both have vocal cords, but the stages of development of those organs are different. One of the most important of the occult laws is that one should not indulge in exhibitionism, one should not drag down occult power by what becomes a mere circus turn. How often does one hear a woman say, "Oh, I met a wonderful man today, he came to my door, he's a Spanish onion seller in the mornings, in the afternoons he sells ladies' wear, and in the evenings he gives occult demonstrations. He is so utterly wonderful, he can balance on one finger while drinking a cup." 105. Of tea upside down. Or how often do we hear of some poor little man, so lonely, so forgotten by the world, that he has to say, "Ah, I have read a book about occultism. I will now set up as a great teacher and a master." So he goes to work by day, perhaps canvassing from door to door, or perhaps being a meek little man under a domineering employer, and by night he sets off to his back room, puts on a mysterious look, flaps his eyebrows up and down, sights down the side of his nose, makes weird sighs and groans, and perhaps also does a stage trick or two, says how wonderfully he can do astral traveling. Actually, he has probably had too much supper or bad cheese, or something, and he has had a nightmare. Well, that little man is a real pest, he is a real danger to occultism and to himself. I am going to tell you that all these crackpots who put on stage shows and call it occultism are going to have to pay time after time until they learn better. They are going to have to come back to this earth, and that should be a threat enough to put anyone off. In India there is a sect of people called the Fake Ears. They pose as holy men, they travel about India and no attractive woman is safe from them. But they put on stage shows, they put on tricks. Well, I for one, if I want to see a conjuring show, I would rather pay and go to a good variety theater. I don't want to see a dirty little man squatting on the ground trying to hypnotize a whole group of people. That doesn't prove anything spiritual to me. It proves, instead, that the person has not even the first conception of spiritualism. The Indian rope trick is just a simple matter of hypnotism. I am going to tell you, though, quite definitely that the real masters who never prove anything to satisfy the idle curiosity seekers can actually do the so-called Indian rope trick by utilizing natural powers, and that does not employ hypnotism. I will tell you quite truthfully that I and many others have seen levitation. Levitation is a very real thing indeed, and it is not at all mysterious. It is a matter of reversing magnetic currents. If you get hold of two magnets, two biomagnets for preference, if you hold them one in each hand and bring them together, they may jump together with a loud metallic clang, often pinching a bit of flesh in between. But if you reverse the direction of just one, that is if you take the one in your right hand, and you put the south pole where the north pole was before and you try to bring these two magnets together, you will find that they make white. 106. Strenuous efforts to evade each other, they oppose each other, they have no magnetic attraction to each other, they have repulsion instead. Another thing, one can have a form of induction coil connected to a battery or to the mains, and over a shaft which projects upwards one can drop an aluminium ring. If the current is switched on, the ring apparently defies gravity and floats in the air. If anyone doubts the truth of this, well, they should consult some scientific magazine or write to the United States for a demonstration kit. But let us get back to what we are discussing seriously. Levitation is a method of altering our own magnetic attraction so that we do not weigh so much. In England about 60 or so years ago there was a young man called Home. He gave an actual demonstration of levitation in an English country house. Some of the world's foremost scientists witnessed the demonstration, but because the demonstration disproved the laws which those scientists had formulated, they would not give an unbiased report. In Tibet and China, before the communists made a commotion there, that is, and Japan, before the United States soldiers made a commotion there as well, one saw a lot of levitation and similar things.